All right, I want to give you some background information today for the purpose of the report, understanding it. But you need to realize that even though I'm delivering this lecture in the laboratory, this is also lecture material. And in fact, I'm going to give you three slides from a chapter we haven't even gotten to yet that I'm not going to give you again in the lecture room. So this is for the test as well. All right, just make sure you realize that. When I show them to you, you'll be able to see their numbers.
Oh, okay.
It'll be just like in the other room, only it's just three slides, not an entire chapter.
Oh, okay, so it's like it's going
to... Well, no, it's all part of Unit 2. Okay, today I want to talk about, eventually I want to talk about what you're really studying here, which is osmosis, but we need to start out a little bit more generally. I want to first tell you that there are three major categories of transport processes that cells use to get things either into themselves or out of themselves. Okay? Living cells need to take things in, they need to get rid of things, and so we call those transport processes. Does anyone know what the three categories are? No, those are things we're going to get to, but those aren't processes. Those are properties. One of them is active transport. That should give you a clue as to what one of them, what another one is. What is it? Well, that's a good guess. No, passive transport is another. And the third is vesicular transport. Now, vesicular transport is named for the fact that it uses vesicles. And that's not really what we're talking about today. So we'll look at that again in the normal lecture room. Just realize that it's one of the three mechanisms. Okay? That leaves us active transport and passive transport. Those two are distinguished on the basis of the need for additional energy. Now, you might have learned about active transport before, and you might have gotten a definition somewhat like something like active transport requires energy and passive transport does not require energy. That's not true. Both of them require energy because you can't get anything to move for free. All right. So even passive transport requires energy. What's different about passive transport is that it doesn't require any additional energy because the energy required for its movement is already built into the system. Active transport, on the other hand, needs additional energy. And therefore, unless additional energy is supplied, it will never happen. Now, something that's important to both of these is the concept of a gradient. A gradient is a real general word. There's all kinds of different gradients. But a gradient is a difference in measurements at two different places. For instance, a pressure gradient is why water comes out of the faucet when you turn it on, because there's higher pressure inside than outside. And so water moves from high pressure to low pressure, down its gradient. And a voltage, like if you use a voltmeter and stick it into the outlet on the wall, you'll measure. A voltage is another name for a gradient of electrical potential energy. It's just easier to say voltage. Okay? Because one of those terminals will have more positive charge than the other. So that's a difference, right? It's a gradient. The gradient type that we care about in today's experiment is a concentration gradient. And we've already talked about concentrations when we talked in general about solutions, right? You're dealing with solutions again. Really, you're dealing with two solutions in each of your dishes, because the potatoes are made up of cells. Each cell has an intracellular fluid. That's a solution, right? But there's also this external solution that the pieces of potato are bathed in. That's also a solution. Okay? And each one of those has its own concentration. But when we talk about concentrations, we're usually talking about concentrations of solutes, right? Well, you can also think about concentration in terms of solvents, which in this case is water, right? So your solution is made up of water particles. They are have such and such a concentration, and solute particles that have a certain concentration. And those values can be different outside the cell and inside the cell, which is why you can have a gradient in place. But a gradient is just a difference. Okay, well anyway, passive transport has as its source of energy, that I said is built in, which is why you don't have to add any additional energy, it has its energy in the form of a gradient. And that's what actually drives the transport, the gradient itself. And if there is no gradient, because the measurement is the same, if the concentration is the same at point A and at point B, that means the gradient is zero and there isn't going to be any passive transport between those two. Okay, now, let me actually explain the transport. What's a little bit counterintuitive is that passive transport is transport that is based on random movement in all directions, but the passive transport has the net effect of being directional, meaning it moves particles in one particular direction. Namely, from high concentration to low concentration. Okay? So it is a directed movement overall, but it's caused by a completely random movement. And that's what seems counterintuitive. So let me use a thought experiment that represents what really happens at the molecular level. If you agree to help me in the model and you all gather in a big room like a gymnasium, each of you is going to represent a solute particle in a solution. The solution is the entire gym's area, okay? But you are individual solute particles, like the sugar in your solutions. Now, in a real population of solute particles, everything is moving, right? Each individual particle is moving at its own speed and in its own direction. And so you'll have to do that, but first we would just gather in the middle. Kind of like representing a crystal of sugar surrounded by a bunch of water. All right, we put a sugar cube into water. But each dot is one of your heads. And we just keep time frozen for the beginning of this experiment. I haven't started the clock yet. So I arrange you. Well, I don't arrange you. I just randomly put you in the middle. And each person is randomly facing its own direction. Whichever way you're facing, that's going to determine what direction you as a particle are going to move at once I start the time. You see what I'm saying? Just like real solute particles. They're going to be heading in a certain direction. And then if you do all of this and I say, okay, now go ahead and start moving. By moving, I simply mean walk in whatever direction you're facing until you hit something. And then change your direction because things bounce off and they start moving in a new direction. All right? Now, if you happen to be one of the many people that are in the middle of this group, you're not going to get very far before you change directions, right? You're just going to run into another particle, another person. You'll change directions, though, and you're just going to be bouncing around in the middle. Yeah?
So wouldn't G all be going the same amount of speeds?
No, you would. To do this correctly, you would also be walking at different speeds.
Okay.
But it's fine if you didn't do that in the model. It would still get the point across. You're bouncing around, changing directions, okay? That's if you're in the middle. Now, if you were on the periphery or the edge of the group, there's still a chance that you're just going to run into people because some of these people on the outer edge could be facing inward, right? So they're not going to get anywhere either. But some of the people on the edge will just be randomly facing outward. And they, therefore, are going to leave the group. And they're going to walk in a straight line until they hit a wall, and then they'll start bouncing around that way, right? And the more that happens, the more solute particles are removed from the cube, or from the big chunk, the more it allows other ones that are still left behind to now be at the new edge. And if they're facing outward, they will leave, right? So that random motion that all the particles are undergoing is called Brownian motion. Random directions, random speeds. But as that occurs, it's going to have the effect of spreading the particles out into the entire container, into the entire gym, right? If I let you do that and I come back a couple hours later, you're all going to be spread out, bouncing off of each other, but spread out through the whole gym. It's no longer going to be a highly concentrated area, right? And so even though it's random motion causing this, the effect is that it moves particles from a higher concentrated area to a lower concentrated area until there's no longer any gradient, right? Once you get all dispersed out, there is no longer any gradient. If I measure it, concentration here and here, it'll be the same when you're all spread out. Okay, so that is passive transport. And passive transport is diffusion. When you spread out, you're diffusing. Diffusion is always passive. There's different kinds of diffusion that we're going to talk about, but diffusion is always passive. And what causes it to occur from high concentration to low concentration is the gradient itself. That gradient is a form of potential energy. And that's what causes it to happen. Okay, now, notice in this example with the humans, or in a real example, if you plunk a sugar cube into a beaker of water, there's no barrier, there's no membrane, right? So that sugar cube in the water, when that first happens, you have a very high concentration of sugar where the sugar cube is, and a zero concentration where the water is, right? So that's a gradient for sugar, and it's going to diffuse away from the high concentration into the water. At the same exact time, though, you also have independently a concentration of water molecules that's high where it's water and low where it's sugar, right? So they are going to diffuse down their own gradient from high concentration of water to low concentration of water. Both are diffusing at the same time in opposite directions until it's all mixed. That's just diffusion. It's not going through any membrane. All right? Well, we can see this in slide 10 of... This isn't even the chapter that we haven't gotten to yet. This is the membrane chapter. I forget what number that is. But anyway, I'm going to go through three slides in here that I won't be going through again in the lecture room. So that's what I was trying to explain earlier. In 10, we can see diffusion through a membrane. Now, that's not the sugar cube example. Here we have a compartment, but it's subdivided into two subcompartments by this dashed line. That dashed line represents not only a membrane, which would normally separate it into two chambers, but it's a membrane that is permeable to certain things and impermeable to others. Permeable means that things can go through it. So we call such a membrane a selectively permeable membrane. Some books use the word semi-permeable, which isn't really as good, because it's really not half permeable. It's selectively permeable because certain types of things can get through it and certain other things can't. All right? Well, in this top case, and it's the same thing in all three columns, it's just going at different times. It's going. This is different times. At first, though, at time zero, you have all of these gold particles, whatever they are, molecules of dye, as it says, they're all on one side of the membrane. And so there is a gradient in place because there's a high concentration here and a low concentration there, right? For diffusion to occur, for it to actually occur, you need to fulfill two requirements. First of all, there has to be a gradient in place. And there is here. But that's not enough. The gradient represents the tendency for diffusion to occur. But it doesn't mean it will occur. The other requirement is that there has to be a way for that type of particle, whatever it is, to get from point A to point B. And if something is preventing that, then you won't have the diffusion, even though you have the tendency. Okay, so you have to have a gradient, you have to have a way for it to get from A to B. Well, here you have both. The gradient is in place, and this selectively permeable membrane happens to be permeable to these dye molecules. So, it's not going to stay in this situation, right? The gradient is the tendency for it to diffuse, and since it can, it will. Now, it's random motion, just like I was talking about here. But because you have more on one side than the other, you're going to have more movement from left to right on this picture than you have from right to left. You're going to have some movement from right to left, but it's going to be more in this direction. And therefore, as you wait, you have less and less of a gradient. And at equilibrium, in this example, there is no gradient anymore. In other words, you continue to have net diffusion in one direction, from higher concentration to lower concentration, until there is no gradient. The gradient is zero. And at zero, you no longer have any net diffusion. That doesn't mean the particles stop. It just means the amount of movement from right to left equals the amount of movement from left to right. So you're just swapping them at that point, and it doesn't change anything about the concentration. Now that's just diffusion through a membrane of a single type of particle, representing a single solute, for instance. On the bottom, you have two different solutes, gold and purple dye molecules. And in this case, the membrane is permeable to both of them. The major point here is something I already told you a little bit ago, namely that if you have two different particles, they have independent gradients. Neither one has anything to do with the other. So there's two gradients in place here. One for the gold dye, and that's in one direction, right? It's going to tend to diffuse them from down their own gradient, from left to right. But the gradient for the purple dye is in the opposite direction, and it doesn't have anything to do with the gold dye's gradient. So that is a separate tendency to move just the purple ones from right to left. And since they both can get through, they both will do that. And at equilibrium, they're spread out. They're both spread out, okay? Now, if this were a membrane that allowed only one of the two dye molecules through but not the other, there would be two tendencies, two gradients, but only one of them would be able to get through, so you'd only have diffusion of one of them. Okay, everything clear on that? Let's then go to 11. That is diffusion through a membrane, and that is really what you're studying today, is diffusion through a membrane rather than just diffusion from one place in a chamber to another place in the same chamber. You're exchanging chambers when you go through the plasma membrane, right? You're either going from extracellular fluid to intracellular fluid or from intracellular fluid to extracellular fluid through a membrane. Well, what's different about 11 is that this is a special case of diffusion. Now, passive transport is always diffusion, and diffusion is always passive. But sometimes, for a special case of diffusion, we give it a different name, even though it's still diffusion. And that special name is osmosis. Osmosis is diffusion. All osmosis is diffusion, but not all diffusion is osmosis. So it's a special case. And there's two things that have to that make it a special case. Two requirements for it to be osmosis and not just regular diffusion. I'll tell you, one of those special things that needs to be met is that the particle moving in osmosis is not a solute particle, but a solvent. In those dye examples in the previous slide, the purple and the orange dye were both solutes. We didn't even look at the water molecules. They were just depicted as the blue background. But they're there, obviously, right? Well, the water molecules, remember, are solvent, not solute. The solutes are dissolved in the solvent. The solvent is dissolving. But anyway, if a diffusion process is going to be called osmosis properly, then it can't be solute that's moving. It has to be solvent that's moving. But that doesn't go far enough either. Because think back to the beaker example I gave you. You put the sugar cube into the beaker, and the water will diffuse from where it's pure water to where it's sugar at the moment, right? That is diffusion, and it's solvent because it's water, but that's not osmosis because it's not enough to say that it's solvent. It also has to be going through a membrane, a selectively permeable membrane. And so that's why the beaker example is not osmosis, but this in slide 11 is. So look what you have as the setup. You have a U-tube. This is the original meaning of U-tube, a U-shaped glass tube in a laboratory. And at the bottom of it, you have a selectively permeable membrane. Now, the selectivity of that membrane is that it allows water through it, but it doesn't allow the solutes through it. Okay? Which is the case for the selectively permeable membrane called the plasma membrane of your potato cells in today's experiment. That's selectively permeable. It won't let ions through or the sugar molecules through, but it will allow water through to a certain extent. All right? Now look at how we're starting it on the upper left. The membrane separates the thing into two subchambers. On the left side of the U-tube, we have a solution. These green things represent some sort of sugar, so it's a sugar solution. The right side is also a sugar solution, and it's the same kind of sugar, but what's the difference between the two solutions?
One is more concentration than the other.
Of what?
Of sugar.
Right. There's a difference. The concentration of the sugar solutions is different, right and left. So, let me tell you what you might have learned osmosis definition to be. Because you probably learned this in a different class, somewhere along the line, in high school or whatever. You might have learned a definition something like this. Osmosis is the diffusion of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. Does that sound familiar? A lot of books say that, and it's true. A couple things about that, though. One is that it doesn't have to be water. It's just the solvent. So in chemistry, you would say solvent rather than water, but in biology, the solvent is always water. That's why biology classes teach it as water. Okay, so that's one thing. But the other thing is that by saying that water moves from low solute concentration to high solute concentration seems a little confusing because it seems like it's opposite of what I just told you diffusion works at, right? Diffusion moves things from high concentration to low concentration. But if you think about how that is worded, it's really just a backwards way of saying it, which is why I think it's confusing. When you say that water moves from a place of low solute concentration to high solute concentration, what does that mean about the wateriness? If you have low solute concentration, what is the water concentration? High, right? It's more watery the lower the solute concentration is. So yes, it's true that water does move in osmosis from low solute concentration to high solute concentration. That's just a backwards way of saying that water is moving from high water concentration to low water concentration. So it's doing the same thing the solutes would be doing if they were diffusing, right? Since it's solvent, though, that's one part of the special case. And if it's happening through a membrane that doesn't allow the solutes through but does allow the solvent, then that is osmosis. Everyone clear on the definition? Then let's see it happening. This is how it is originally. Now, there are two gradients in place because there are two types of particles. Water particles, which aren't shown individually, but it's all the blue background. And solute particles, the sugar ones. But the selectivity of the membrane is such that the sugar can't get through, the water can. There are two separate independent gradients, though, a water gradient and a solute gradient, sugar gradient. They both represent a tendency for diffusion to occur. And if the membrane allowed water and solutes through, then that's all you would have is diffusion of both. But the sugar wants to get through, that's the gradient speaking, it can't. The water wants to get through, but can, and therefore it will. And since it's watery on the left side, more watery, it's going to move from left to right. Water is. Clear? Down its own gradient, as diffusion always happens, down the gradient. Well, the more that happens, the more you're taking water from the left and putting water, adding water to the right. Which means you're making the left concentration more concentrated, right? Just like boiling it would, because you're removing water, but you're leaving the same amount of solute there. And at the same time, you're making the right concentration less concentrated because you're adding solvent, but keeping the same amount of solute. You're thinning it out, watering it down. Now notice that this is drawn in such a way that it looks like it's about the same concentration on both sides. That could happen, and that would be one way that the osmosis would eventually stop. It would come to equilibrium because there's no more difference in water concentration. There's no more gradient in place. That's one way it could stop. That's not the only way, though. And you have to picture this, but imagine the same setup, except on the left is pure water, no sugar at all, and some sugar in the right. You still have the same gradient direction. Water is still going to want to move from left to right, right? From where it's more watery to where it's less watery. And so it will. Now let's say that happens a little bit. You're making the right side more dilute, but the left side that never had any sugar in it to begin with, it's still pure water. There's just less of it there, right? So no matter how dilute you make the right side, it still has a higher sugar concentration than this, and therefore it still has a lower water concentration than the left side. You see what I mean? And so you're never going to get to the point where there's no gradient. Something else brings it to equilibrium, though. And that's gravity. Because as you remove water from the left and put it in the right by osmosis, the difference in the levels changes, right? The right level goes high, the left level goes low. Well, this bigger column, vertically, is going to be affected by gravity more. It's going to be pulled down more. So gravity is trying to pull water down, forcing it back to the left. Osmosis, the gradient for water, is trying to force water from left to right. And when those two forces exactly equal each other, then that will be equilibrium in a different way. Okay? But the point is, even at equilibrium, there is going to be movement through the membrane. It just won't be movement in one direction more than the other. That's when it's more in one direction than another, that's when you use the word net. It's what I meant when I earlier said net diffusion. Well, you won't have any net osmosis once the forces are equal, or once the gradient is the same. Now, think about your potato cell for a second. It has a certain solution inside it. It's not just a single solute, there's many solutes. So it's a complex solution, but it's an aqueous solution, so you know whatever solutes there are, the solvent is water. All right? Doesn't matter what the solutes are, it only matters what the total solute concentration is. Because what really matters, remember the gradients are all independent, it's not the solute's gradient that matters in osmosis, it's only the water's gradient. So if you measure the total solute concentration, that's really an indirect way of measuring the water concentration, right? And what I'm getting at is you could have the same setup in a U-tube with totally different solutes on the two sides. One salt and one sugar, for instance. And if neither of those can get through, but the water can, then water is only going to move if the wateriness is different. If you have a 1 molar concentration of sugar on the left and a 1 molar concentration of salt on the right, then they will be equally watery, right? Even though it's totally different kinds of solutes. It's only water's concentration gradient that matters. So osmosis is only going to happen when the wateriness is different, and it always happens from more watery to less watery, down its own gradient. Well, that brings up slide 12, which has to do with tonicity. There are three phrases at the top that are different degrees of tonicity. Tonicity refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur through a cell membrane. And I need to alert you to something that a lot of instructors get this wrong even, including the instructor that wrote this manual, so that it will be wrong, it'll be erroneously stated in the manual. But let me tell you the truth. These three degrees of tonicity, which are hypertonic, hypotonic, and isotonic, none of those words should ever be used to describe a cell. Those words are used to describe the cell's surroundings, what is outside of the cell, the environment, okay? Which in your case would be the solution that they're bathing in, not the cells themselves. Okay, that's one thing. So when you recognize, when you see those in the lab, pay attention to what I said. It is wrong the way it's stated in the lab. Never, and so I'm saying this because you're writing up a report. In your report, do not describe cells as hypertonic, hypotonic, or isotonic. Use those words for the environment. Okay, so that's one confusing thing. Another is confusing thing about these words is that their word meaning has to do with the solute particles, even though I just told you that the solute particles are not what matter. It's the water particles, which are solvent, right? So it's kind of backwards how they're named. But I'll explain how it makes sense. What does hypo, just as a prefix, mean? Like in hypodermic. Means below the skin. Hypo means below. Okay? Hyper means above. And iso means same or equal. Now here's where it's backwards in how it's really named. These prefixes are used to denote the solute concentrations. Okay? And so hypertonic, well, let me start with hypotonic since it's on the left. Hypotonic is called that because it has a lower solute concentration, hypo meaning below, a lower solute concentration than the cell does. Remember, we're describing the environment. So a hypotonic environment has a lower solute concentration than the cell does. And the reason that's backwards is because what really matters is the water, not the solutes, right? But think about what it means to have a low solute concentration. That means it's more watery than the cell. So that's how you should think of, from now on, hypotonic solutions. They are more watery than the cell itself. And therefore, if a cell is placed in a hypotonic solution, if it's surrounded by hypotonic solution, and water is allowed to get through that membrane, osmosis will occur, right? There's a gradient in place. That hypo tells you there's a gradient because it's lower than the cell, or more watery than the cell, I should say. Whenever osmosis occurs, every time, water is moving from where it's more watery to where it's less watery. Since a hypotonic solution having a lower solute concentration is more watery than the cell, water is going to move from the outside into the cell. Is that all clear? And you can see that happening here. Now, if this is a red blood cell, for instance, as a typical animal cells, unlike plant cells, have only a plasma membrane. All cells have a plasma membrane, but an animal cell, that's all it has. It doesn't also have a cell wall exterior to that like a plant cell does. A plasma membrane is flimsy. So an animal cell in a hypotonic environment is going to take up water by osmosis, because water is going from where it's more watery to less watery. That's going to stretch the membrane, and if it's drastic enough, it will explode, as you see happening here. That explosion of an animal cell in a hypotonic environment is called lysis. Same word as in hydrolysis that we've been talking about in lecture. It means splitting. So it bursts open, which is obviously bad for the cell. It kills that cell. But that's what a hypotonic solution is, one that is more watery than the cell that's in it. Let's go to the opposite extreme first before the middle. Hypertonic is just the reverse. Hypertonic literally means having a higher solute concentration than the cell, but that's a backwards way of saying it has a lower water concentration than the cell. It's less watery than the cell. Just the opposite of hypotonic. And so, once again, there is a gradient in place for water, but it's in the reverse direction, right? So a cell in a hypertonic environment is going to lose water. Water, once again, is going to go from where it's more watery to less watery, but now more watery is in the cell, so it leaves the cell. Well, this is going to cause shrinkage of the cell. And once again, if it's an animal cell, it doesn't have that cell wall around it. It's a flimsy plasma membrane, and so it shrivels up like you see. And that shriveling is called crenation. Crenation is also bad for the cell. It will kill the cell if it's severe as well. So animal cells don't do well in hypertonic or hypotonic environments. Isotonic, on the other hand, means the same, right? This is what I was getting at a little bit earlier, though. The outside of the cell, the environment, can be isotonic even if it's a totally different kind of solution. You know, it can be a totally different set of solutes outside the cell than inside. But if they are the same concentration inside than outside, then the wateriness is the same. And if the wateriness is the same, there is no gradient for water, and therefore it's not going to go in one direction more than the other. Instead, it's going to go in both directions at the same time. Water is going to enter the cell and leave it at the same rate. It's just a swap. And there is no volume change in the cell. That's the ideal condition for an animal cell to be in an isotonic environment. And that's why a big part of your overall body's homeostasis is to maintain your extracellular fluid as an isotonic state so your cells can function. All right, that's for animals. Plants are shown on the bottom by just for comparison. They have their own plasma membrane, but exterior to that is a much thicker and tougher cell wall. Very similar to the actual wall of this room. The structural wall is like the cell wall. The paint on the interior is like the flimsy plasma membrane. Okay? A plant that is in a hypertonic environment still has the same tendency for water to lose it. Osmotically, right? Because it's more watery inside the cell than outside. So it's going to lose water. When that happens in a plant cell, the paint's going to peel off the wall, basically, because you're losing that plasma membrane will collapse, but since the cell wall is so thick and rigid, it stays in place. And that is going to be fatal for that plant cell. So plants don't do well in a hypertonic environment. By the way, that's given a separate name. That's not crenation for a plant. It's called plasmolysis. Okay. A plant in an isotonic solution can survive, but that's not ideal either, because it leaves the plant cell flaccid, meaning not swollen, just limp. On the other hand, if you have a plant cell that's in a hypotonic environment, where the surroundings are more watery, then it's going to take in water by osmosis, right? That's going to swell it up. That would kill an animal cell, but that plant has that strong cell wall holding in the pressure. So we call a swollen plant cell turgid. It has turgidity, meaning it's nice and pressurized. Well, this is not the only plant, the only cell in the plant. There are billions of cells in the overall plant's body. And if they're all turgid by taking up water by osmosis, they're all pressing on each other. And this causes an erection in the plant. This is why you don't have to actually have a tree with wood for it to stand up. Just what would otherwise be a flimsy green seedling will still stand up, only if you give it enough water to maintain a hypotonic environment so that it's taking the water in and pushing on each other. It's very much like an erection of a penis, except that's from blood pressure and this is by osmotic pressure for water. Yeah.
Well, two questions. What are the labels on the bottom? Because I know there's some of them that are not.
Flaccid just means limp. Turgid means pressurized. And plasmolyzed is just the verb form of plasmolysis. That's the noun.
Okay. And then the very last one on the plant. So.
That's plasmolyzed.
Is there a reason why it's like scrunched up?
Yeah, because this is the plasma membrane. That's what I said. The plasma membrane is like the paint. It peels away from the cell wall. Because it's losing the water, but the wall won't collapse because it's much stronger. But that's bad for the cell. Okay, everything clear on that? That's all I wanted to say about the slides. Now let me talk more about the actual experiment and your report. I'm going to tell you exactly how to make your graph. And I do this every term, and it's never been the case of even coming close to everyone doing it correctly, even though I'm telling you exactly how to do it. So pay attention to this. First of all, let's talk about variables, which graphs involve, right? It's an experiment, so there should be a dependent variable and an independent variable. What is the independent variable? The concentration of the solutions, exactly. That's what you adjust, remember. Independent is what you adjust. Dependent is what you measure, which is going to be what? The difference, or the change in the mass. Yes, you do have, you do weigh it, but that's not what you're actually going to graph. So this is one error that I get that people do wrong. Don't graph mass on the y-axis. Instead, graph change in mass. Now, what symbol do we use in science to represent change? A delta, a capital delta, which is an equilateral triangle, but it's a Greek D. So delta whatever means change in whatever. Okay, so we're going to be doing change in mass as the dependent variable versus concentration of solution, right? Now you should write these out. I'm just doing shorthand. Now what else do you need on these labels besides just names? Units. So the change in mass is going to be in grams, right? In parentheses. What about the units of concentration? Molar. Capital M. Right? Okay, next is another thing that people do wrong. Go ahead.
In the book it has the GMs.
It's supposed to be GM. The book's, that's one of the many things it's wrong about. Here's another thing that people do wrong. What are your three concentrations? 0, 0.3, and 0.5. I talked about this a little bit when I gave you that first lecture, the first week, when in the metric system week. Where are those on the number line? Zero is right in the middle, right? 0.2, did you say 0.2? Or 3? 0.3. 0.3, if these are all 0.1, that would be right here, right? And 0.5 is right here. Those are not the same distance apart. So don't give me a graph that says 0, 0.3, and 0.5 like they are red, blue, and green. These are numbers, not categories. So they need to be spaced appropriately. It's a numeric axis, not a categoric axis. Okay, so don't do that. 0.3 should be closer to 0.5. Everyone understand that? Okay, we'll see how many people do it anyway. Now, this means, now you have it set up properly, so I mean, well, you also have a title, of course. But anyway, you're going to get your data today. Your data, your raw data, really, are your initial and your final masses for each of the three. But you're not graphing those, like I said. Instead, you use the initial and the final to compute change in mass. And change in mass, which I'll just do as delta sub m equals, or I'm saying, change in mass, delta m equals mass final, m sub f, minus mass initial. So your ending mass minus your initial mass. Now notice that when you do that, the answer, the delta M, can be either positive or negative, depending on how the change is, right? Which one would give you a negative number? If what is true? What would have to be true for this to be negative? The beginning mass would what? It would have to be larger. When you subtract a larger thing from a smaller thing, it's going to be negative. So a negative delta mass means that you've lost water from the cells, right? Because you ended up with a smaller mass. Does that make sense conceptually? And conversely, a positive delta mass means that water has gone into the cell via osmosis. And what would a zero delta mass mean? It means that it hasn't changed mass, right? Now you might not get exactly zero. In fact, you almost certainly won't get exactly zero. But let's say you did get exactly zero. It means that there is an overall change in mass, right? But what does it mean for osmosis? Water was going in and out at the same speed, and therefore no change, right? When would this happen? In what kind of situation? in an isotonic environment that would happen. Okay, so you might not have isotonic, not one of your three might be isotonic. None of them might be isotonic. But one of the questions in the manual asks you to figure out what the concentration is inside the cell. This is an indirect question. You can't answer that directly, because directly means you'd have to go into the cell and count all the solute particles and then divide by the volume, right? You're not going to do that. But the reason you can indirectly get this is because if you can figure out what the concentration of a hypotonic solution is, which would by definition not change the mass, then that would have to be the same concentration inside the cell, because that's what it means to be isotonic, right? So that's where you have line fitting come into play. Go ahead.
What if the value for that to meet that equal equilibrium is outside our data points? Isn't that extrapolating?
It would be extrapolation, yes.
But you don't want us to do that?
Well, it's not a good practice, but you would have to do it because you're told to in this case. And it might not happen also. It might be interpolation only.
Okay.
Let's just think about some graphs. And I'm not saying this is how yours is going to look. So this is just an example. But let's say that you have a point here for 0, a point here for 3, 0.3, and here for 0.5. They don't all perfectly line up. Yeah?
On the graph, because on the little chart it has 0.0, if you want to put 0 or 0.0.
0.0 is 0. You can add as many zeros to that as you want because it's pure water.
Yeah.
So you can have as many significant figures as you want, but that's done just because the others are to one decimal place. Yeah. So it's not perfect linearity, right? Just as usual, there are some errors. But you can see that there's a trend, right? And therefore you can fit a line to these data, not this data. Anyway, that's an approximately good fit. And since this is change in mass, you could have negative numbers and positive numbers, right? And therefore zero somewhere in the middle. Not necessarily here, but somewhere between positive and negative, right? So this is, you won't have a zero, or you won't have any negatives if you don't do change in mass. If you do mass instead of change in mass, they'll all be positive, right? That's why you don't want to do that. You want to do change in mass. Okay, so none of these is actually zero. Let's say you measured. But by fitting the line of best fit, wherever zero is on the scale, you can extend a line directly over to the line of best fit, and then directly down, and whatever that concentration is means if you had actually tested that concentration as your environment, it should have led to a zero change in mass, right? Which by definition would mean that whatever that concentration is would be hypotonic. And therefore, the cell would have the same concentration, right? Everyone follow all that? Because that's really what that question is asking you in a backwards way, in an indirect way. It's asking you to predict what the concentration of the cell is. And you do that by predicting what an isotonic concentration would be for the environment. And you do that by the definition of isotonicity, no change in mass. Means isotonicity. That means zero on your scale. So you figure out where zero is and what concentration it corresponds to. That's why it tells you to make an X on the line of best fit where it crosses zero on the y-axis, because that's the special point, even though you didn't actually do that point. Yeah.
So when we graph it, you want us to always keep the axis below whatever our values are?
You don't want to have a bunch of white space. So
yeah.
So do it a little bit lower than the lowest, up to a little bit higher than the highest for both y and x.
I was just wondering, because I know in physics we put our axis at zero and then you just have the graph go through Do you know what I'm referring to? Like, I'm wondering if we put the zero in the middle of the chart and our axis is like this, but zero's up here.
It doesn't have to be in the middle.
Like
it doesn't have to be in exact middle. It just you want to spread your graph out as much as possible for the actual data. So you don't want to have a bunch of space down here before your first datum. You don't want to have a bunch of space up here, and therefore the zero might be only a third of the way up or whatever. You just want the lowest one to be a little space below it and the highest one a little space above it. And then zero where it falls in that range. Then does everyone understand exactly what this process is? Because about 60% of the class gets this wrong on the report and does it incorrectly. So don't just tell me like you did the first day that when you said, I understand how to do dimensional analysis, and then almost no one did it right on the quiz. Don't say you understand this if you don't really. Talk to me about it if you don't, in other words. All right? But that's really what you're doing here. You're giving these potatoes three different environments. Now, they might not be all three. You label them as hypertonic, hypotonic, or isotonic based on the change in mass. Which ones are going to be hypotonic? Which measurements? Based on what we've talked about. Positive delta masses, yes. That means they've gained mass, right? They'll do that in a hypotonic environment because a hypotonic environment is more watery than the cell, so water will go into the cell. Negative values will mean hypertonic. And you probably won't have an exact zero, which would be isotonic. That's why you find it by interpolation. But you can have two hypertonics or two hypotonics, just different degrees of hypertonicity or hypotonicity, right? Still, if it's negative, you should consider that to be hypertonic. If it's positive, hypotonic. Everyone good on all that? Then the only other thing you're doing today, besides getting your numbers and making your drawing, which I'll talk about in just a second, is to look at this display. And people get this wrong too because, I don't know, maybe it's labeled badly or something. It's labeled before and after, and that's the important thing. People tend to think that these are two different dishes because in reality they are. But the labeling before and after means you're supposed to pretend that this is the same thing before and after. Okay? So something has occurred in this one raisin dish that you're pretending. And the same thing for the strawberries. So keep that in mind when you look at them for that little part. The only other thing before I shut up is the drawing of your whiteboard thing. Now you want to do this not only because it's in the protocol, but because you get bonus points in your report. This one you can actually have more than 100% because you get bonus points for doing the drawing. What the drawing needs to be, you divide it into three, one for each of your three dishes, but you're drawing just a single potato cell in each one of the environments to represent the millions that are in your potato, but just one cell. And then you use different colors and different shapes, and you have to have a key on it somewhere to tell me which shape is which, to represent water. So I don't care whether you use triangles for water or whatever, but you have to have water molecules, you have to have sugar molecules, and you have to have starch molecules. Now, where are the starch molecules?
Inside the
potato cells. And they are huge because they're polysaccharides, right? So they can't get out, even though they want to by diffusion. They can't get out. So draw those only in the plant cells. The sugar is outside the cell and can't get in, right? Except there's no sugar in the zero concentration one. So don't draw any sugar for that one. But in the other two, draw it on the outside. And then water molecules are going to be found in both, right? Inside and outside. But you need to draw them, enough of them, so that you can tell what the concentrations are. You need to label one of these things as hypotonic, one as isotonic, and one as hypertonic. And how should the hypertonic appear with respect to water molecules? Where? What does hypertonic mean? It means less watery, right? But that's not for the cell. You don't use these words to describe cells, only the environment. So the hypertonic part of your board should have a lot more water molecules inside the cell than outside. And therefore, they're going to move in which direction? Out of the cell. So that's what your arrows are going to be for. How are your arrows going to be on the isotonic? Both in and out, evening each other out. Everyone clear on all that? Okay, now I'll shut up.